Science can't explain everything. Just because you can't see me doesn't mean I'm not here.
Thank you for joining me, everyone, and welcome to Paranormal Encounters podcast series. My name is Dr. Kelly Renee Schutz. I am the host and the producer of this show. Sit back, grab yourself some popcorn, and let's get started.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yes, good evening, everyone. Let's get started. So we have a double header for this show. Mr. Steve Stockton is in the house. He is best known as the author of several books on missing persons and disappearances in the national state parks, and he has his own experiences that we are also going to chat about on the show. So sit back, because we're going into part one tonight, and soon part two, where we will continue our discussion. And once again, enjoy the show.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.
Well, hello, Steve, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Dr. Kelly. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I can't wait to talk with you today. Very interesting topic we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to get into a little bit about Steve's books on the disappearances in the national parks. And also we're going to talk to him a little bit about his own experiences as he was growing up, and even maybe to current. So, Steve, what I usually do, and most people know this of me, is that I like to find out a little bit about humble beginnings. And so if you wouldn't mind us going way back to the beginning, how did your upbringing influence you and, I guess, inspire you to get to this point in your life?
Well, I grew up in the hills and hollers of East Tennessee, Appalachia, mm-hmm. Knoxville, Oak Ridge area, kind of a unusual upbringing. My mom was, her family's originally from the Cades Cove area, the Smokies, very superstitious mountain folk. Mm-hmm. And my dad was from Middle Tennessee, Jamestown, which is over on the Cumberland Plateau. Not much over there, but he went to University of Tennessee, also my alma mater, and got an education, ended up working at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Mm-hmm. So I had the rocket scientist father and the superstitious Appalachian mother. So it was a strange mix. Mm-hmm. And my maternal grandmother was a self-styled, she called herself a gypsy witch, but nowadays they'd call her a granny witch or a kitchen witch. She just used whatever she had on hand. The bowl that she used for scrying at night might hold biscuit gravy in the morning. Yeah. So nothing particular there. She told fortunes, read tea leaves, coffee grounds, animal entrails, could tell things about you by feeling the bumps on your head, which is called phrenology, kind of a lost art, popular mm-hmm. around the turn of the last century, I think. So mm-hmm. she was the biggest influence on me as far as superstitions and ghost stories and tall tales from the hills and things. And she knew every little thing to keep bad luck away or to get good luck to come to you. things like that. She did potions and all that. And I was actually afraid of her when I was a child because she looked like a witch. She was a small, weighed like less than 100 pounds, hunched over, had arthritis in her fingers. So she looked like the witch out of Hansel and Gretel or something. And she liked to get me alone in her sewing room and regale me with stories from the mountains and the hills and stuff. In her eyes, I was a special child. She had 10 kids herself, 9 boys, and my mom being the only girl. So I couldn't get away with anything. My mom had 9 brothers. She knew every trick. But I was the only one born with, in Appalachia, they call it being born with a caul over your face or being born with a veil over your face. All that is the afterbirth, the amniotic sac. Was still over my face when I was born. My grandmother was at my birth, and of course they just cut it away, and it's rare, but not really that rare. But in her superstitious mind, that marked me as somebody with wild talents or special abilities and things. I don't make any claims to that, but she believed in it, so...
Very interesting. Wow. You'd be the first that I've heard of something like that. I do want you to still go back, though, to your younger years with her. So at what age were you when you started maybe, now I know that this was kind of part of your family fabric, okay? So you're growing up with this, and you've got a grandmother who is very much into this. At that time, though, did you think as a child that this was something every family might have gone through? Or did you think that you came from a family that was a little bit, I'm not going to use the word different because different has many, many thoughts to that. So just put that, and I want to say unique, but I want to get your ideas as a youngster, just learning about this stuff and how people reacted to you. Around you.
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of in the regard that you don't have any idea than what your own normal is, and it seemed quite normal, but there was a part of me that thought, you know, this is kind of weird, because I would go to school and talk about, you know, how my granny had held a seance, or they'd use the Ouija board, and other kids are looking at me like, you know, we don't do that stuff in my family, but it like I said, it was normal to me. But I first started realizing things were really different when I was around 4 years old. I would see things and hear things that nobody else saw or heard. Saw a full body apparition between 5 and 6 years old. And it didn't scare me at all. I was just like, what was that? You know, and it kind of piqued my interest. And that's really what started my interest in the paranormal. And told my granny about that. And she's just like, very cryptically, well, sometimes you'll see things that are meant for you. You may or may not understand them, except in retrospect, if at all. Other times, it may be something meant for another person, but you'll still be able to see it. Now, they believed in signs and warnings and portents and things like that as part of their superstitious beliefs. But that was just kind of her explanation. Again, it didn't make a lot of sense to me. But she seemed to know things that she shouldn't have had any way of knowing. On the way to her house, there was a spot on the highway where some years before a child chasing a ball had run out into the road in front of a car and been struck and killed. And I always felt something. I'd get like goosebumps when I passed by there, whether I was even looking at it or not. And one evening I was laying in the back seat of the car reading a comic book. This was in the late 60s, early 70s. So seatbelts weren't a deal. But, I sort of felt that strange sensation. I sat up and looked. Sure enough, we're passing by the farmhouse where that happened. When we get to my grandmother's house, she whisked me into her. It had been a dining room at one time. She lived in a big old two-story Victorian farmhouse. But once the farm, they had a dairy farm, and then they did produce farming, truck farming. And once all that was said and done, she just sitting there in this big old house on an empty farm, and it turned that big dining room where she fed 10 kids and a husband and no telling how many farmhands, she turned that into her sewing room. So during the warmer months, her and one of her sisters would cut quilt pieces and get grocery bags full of them and then in the colder months, she'd sit in there and piece quilts together. Well, she'd take me in there. It was always dark and kind of spooky when there wasn't any activity in there. And I don't remember what she was referring to exactly, but she said, "You feel things." And I thought, "Well, yeah, I've got feelings like anybody else." Mm-hmm. And she said, "No, I mean, you feel things like that spot on the highway on the way here tonight." Mm-hmm. And I just, my jaw hit the floor because I hadn't said a word. I didn't mention it to my parents. I certainly didn't mention it to her. I just kind of peeked out the car window and thought, "Oh, you know, this is where that kid died." Mm-hmm. And, but she knew that. She knew somehow what had happened to me that day. I mean, right when we were 20, 25 miles away from her house. And I heard other stories like that. I talked to a lady much, much later in life. And she said, "When I was a teenager, me and a couple of friends of mine walked several miles to your grandmother's house to get our fortunes told." Mm. And she said, "And on the way there, I was kind of making fun of the whole thing. I didn't really believe in it. I was kind of mocking her." She said, we get to her house. We're standing on the porch. We knock on the door. Mm. Your grandmother comes to the door. We said, "We're here, Mama Bessie," was what everybody called her. Mm-hmm. "To Mama Bessie, we're here to get our fortunes told." Mm-hmm. And she kind of looks at him and she says, "Well, I'll tell your fortune and I'll tell your fortune." She points at the one who was mocking her and said, "But I won't tell yours because you don't believe in me."
Oh, interesting.
And it scared her to death. She was just, you know, in her teens at the time. She said there was no way she could have heard that because we walked 2 or 3 miles to get there. And mm-hmm. But she had that penchant. She knew things that she shouldn't have known.
I want to talk a little bit about her a little bit more here because you've got me fascinated. You know, I'm just kind of rolling through the reels of my own past with my own grandparents. And how old was she around when you were young and all this was going on? What age was she?
She passed away when I was 13. Okay. And I believe she was in her early 80s at the time. I'd have to check for sure. I should know, but it's I'm getting older myself, and I don't remember a lot of dates and things. I believe she was in her early 80s.
Early 80s.
She would have been in her 70s anyway when I knew her as a kid. And like I said, she looked like a witch. Mm. I was scared of her when I was smaller. But by the time I was 13, I was totally fascinated by her, mm-hmm. and I wish I'd had at least another 13 years to spend with her.
Yeah, that's the point about many of us with our grandparents and those that are our elders. We wish we had a little bit more time as we're younger. You know as well as I do that kids have different interests and all that. And then as we get older here, we wish the one person that or two people that we could have asked some questions about, they end up being gone. And then, you know, what do we do, right? It's kind of like then you have to do some research and kind of go through and see if you can make sense out of what you're reading. And then, of course, I don't know about you, because I think you kind of might are. I'm a big genealogist, so I'd love to connect the dots of the past. But yeah, when you describe her, it reminds me of this house on the way to my grandparents' house, who lived in the country, and they lived in a very running water was outside. They had no running water. They had no electricity at the time. They had an outhouse, et cetera, lived very frugally, but was the premier house of the country in the county. And we used to pass by this one house on the way to theirs, and I always got the creeps because mm-hmm. I just pointed it out a week ago to my husband. I said, "You see that house right there?" As we turned this corner, I said, "That's where I thought a witch always lived," right? And so we get those impressions when we're younger. But of course, we all know that it's age that you know depicts the person. But did you ever find out in learning a little bit more about her? Did you ever find out if she had if her own family, her own mother, her own grandparents had any of these gifts, or if they all practiced like this? I would be curious to know that.
Yeah, they did. In fact, her mother lived with them when my mother was a child. So she, mm-hmm. I've never met her, of course, but I had heard a lot of stories of my great-grandmother. And it was kind of the same thing, the superstitions and the stories. Mm-hmm. and the tales and stuff. Now, the great-grandmother, she was first-generation American. They had come over from England and landed in the Cades Cove area and actually stayed with another family. My brother was the big genealogist in our family, and he tracked both sides a long way. Never could find where she got the gypsy witch part, but we think somewhere way back in the lineage there was probably Eastern Europe, somewhere from that angle was where she got the gypsy stuff, because it did kind of go along with some of that aesthetic. But the great grandmother was into it. Like I said, they regularly, when my grandmother was a young girl, they did the same thing. They held seances. They were spiritualists before there was such a thing, really. Mm-hmm. And then when that movement came along around the turn of the last century, they were heavily involved in that. And it carried on for probably well up into the 70s or so. And then one of her 10 sons, he was kind of in the middle. He was felt the call to preach. And then once he started preaching, he was a Baptist, Southern Baptist preacher. And I don't know if you know anything about the Southern Baptists, but a lot of them really get into the hellfire and brimstone preaching. And he did, and he basically condemned all of them and told them that they needed to change their ways. And they left a lot of that behind, a lot of the superstition and the Ouija boards and the seances and stuff went out the window when he became a pastor. So up until that point, though, they were just hog wild with it. And it was awesome. I mean, they did like the table tappings and some of that stuff, and it was fascinating, and that was where I got the idea to start writing out these stories, was at her funeral. I was looking at her in her coffin, and even up until like just a couple weeks before she died, she was up climbing around in the barn loft looking for a hen nest where the hens would climb up there and lay eggs.
Yeah.
And that was the stillest I'd ever seen her, because she was always on the go. Mm-hmm. One of these little old people that even in the summertime, she had two ovens in her kitchen, because she was used to cooking for literally an army of children and farmhands. Mm-hmm. And you go there in July, she's wearing a sweater. She's in the kitchen with both ovens going. I'm about to melt.
Yeah.
I've never seen her so still and so quiet. Of course, she was deceased. And I thought, you know, everything she ever told me, every story, every, they call them haints, ghost stories, haint tales, or boogers. Boogers were things in the woods, cryptids and things that could catch you if you got out after dark. But every haint, every booger, every witch story or superstition or anything, because there was good witches and bad witches. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, it dies right there with her, and that's the end of it. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to let that happen. So I had that epiphany at her funeral that I'm going to write these down, so that at least somebody can read them. I'll pass them on to my kids or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I started cataloging them then at 13 years old and continued on, and didn't actually publish the first book till I was probably 40 or so, and maybe older than that.
I think that is absolutely outstanding, quite honestly, especially someone who took an interest in seeing the importance of some of that past. Because I find that to be very fascinating, you know, and it's very rare that you meet somebody who has actually kind of lived through that in a different way. Now, of course, the question is, I think you might have mentioned a little bit earlier that she felt you might have had some gifts yourself just because of how you were born. But do you find that to be true? So let's look at you. Now in your, let's see, you said you saw your first apparition. I guess my first question would be, where did you see this apparition, and what did this apparition look like?
It was out in the country in East Tennessee where I grew up. We lived on a 25-acre farm. Mm-hmm. The driveway was 212 feet long. I remember that. I measured it later on from doing bicycle sprint races. Mm-hmm. But I was about the middle of the yard, so maybe 100 feet away from the road. And I saw a car coming down the hill. There was a T intersection there, and an inverted T with a stop sign. Okay. And had some new neighbors. They'd moved in down the road So the closest neighbor was over a mile away. But they had a son that was around my age, and we played together. I was a year older than him. So I was almost six. He was almost five. Yeah. And I thought it was him coming home from somewhere. So mm-hmm. I started walking out toward the street mm-hmm. and near the road. This is a country road. Mm-hmm. And the car that had stopped at the stop sign, I didn't recognize it. This was a dead-end road that ended into the lake. And I didn't recognize the car. And I thought, well, that's not John's mom's car. That's not John's mom's driving. It was some man. And then I see a child come out from behind the car, comes around the passenger side, crosses at an angle in front of it, runs across the road. And I'm thinking, you know, that kid's going to get hit because that right. man in the car can't see him.
Right.
This is toddler, like mm-hmm. between one and two, I would guess. Mm-hmm. He runs across the street and down into our yard. And yep. this whole time I'm walking toward the street mm-hmm. and he got maybe a half a dozen steps or so into our yard. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever watched little kids that have just barely mastered the art of walking, mm-hmm. sometimes they'll start running and they don't know how to stop. Right. And
just fall yeah, down. Keep going.
That's what this little boy did. Mm-hmm. But when he fell, Kelly, he was just gone. I mean, poof. And I didn't take my eyes off the spot. I went straight to it. There was no child there, no hole that a child could have fallen into, nothing that I could have mistaken for a child. And I still, and again, I explained this to my grandmother, and she gave me that cryptic response. Mm-hmm. I later in life, I've come to think that it was either something that was attached to that car mm-hmm. or that was attached to the person driving it. I mean, that road dead ended into the lake. Yeah. He could have had the body of a child in the trunk of that car.
Yeah.
Who knows? But it was a little boy dressed in the what they dressed kids in at that time. He had on little blue shorts, mm-hmm. matching blue suspenders, a white shirt, a blue cap, mm-hmm. and little white leather shoes and white socks. Blonde hair. I see it just as plain today in my mind as I did back then.
Wow.
But again, it didn't scare me. It didn't upset me. I was just like, you know, what was that? Little kids yeah. don't run into the yard and fall down and disappear.
Right.
And at one point, I even took a shovel and went out there and dug to see if there was a body or something out right. there. But never nothing. Found anything, never got a clue. And much later in life, I did a lot of history. That road that the car came down to the bottom of the hill there, that was named after my grandparents because their dairy farm mm-hmm. at that time had been on that road. Mm-hmm. And I asked people that had lived on that road since its inception, back from when it was a dirt road onto the farm. Mm-hmm. Nobody other than my grandfather did run over his nephew accidentally with a cattle truck. Okay. And killed him, but he was like 12 years old when that happened.
How old was this kid?
Between one and two, just a tiny little kid. So unless the kid was able to come back as his baby self.
Yes.
That was the only death that I ever found on that road.
Yeah, that just hit me as you said that. Because just to add to your story a little bit, just a little bit about that. I had photographed in a screened window in the house I was telling you about my grandparents with outdoor running water and all that, nothing inside. There was a gal, she would be my great grandmother, aunt, great aunt or something, I think. And she showed in the window, and I clear as day, as maybe a 6-year-old, but mm-hmm. she technically died as a 10-year-old, and she died 2 miles down the road. And of course I talk on my podcast a number of times about and she was with what I believe to be my grandfather, great grandfather, who built that house. Mm-hmm. There's a long story behind it, but what I usually bring up on my shows is, did I really see them? Were they really my relatives? Because that's where I learned I was telepathic. Because they told me to check the genealogy. There was an error with her name in the genealogy. And that's what it all just kind of fell into place. And I thought, wow. And it was right. I was wrong in my genealogy and I did correct all that. But when you bring up the fact that this little kid full of life running, you know, in that period clothes and stuff. And what were the years? Now the years apart from her would have been about 4, maybe, you know, and she came back as her younger self, if that was her. So what are we looking at here with the child that got run over versus the little baby child?
The nephew that got run over and killed, he was 12 at the time.
12.
And the baby would have been, that I saw, was, like I said, between 1 and 2. So it would
wow.
have been like a 10-year difference. And then this would have been probably 20 or more years after the fact when he ran over his nephew.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they were getting ready to take some cattle to market, mm-hmm. and he got in the truck and started up, and the nephew saw that one of the calves' legs was sticking out through the slats, mm-hmm. and he ran over to push the calf's leg in.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather didn't know he was behind the truck,
backed over him. Wow, that is something else. And yes, from what I understand, it is possible that they, now I don't have any fact base behind this, but I have heard that sometimes, and even though you're a child like that, though, even at that age, it's not, I don't even know half the time if they're even, they say they're sometimes are offered a, what age do you want to be shown or come back as?
Yeah.
You know, I'm surprised that maybe this child would say, oh, I'd like to be kind of in my baby self. You know what I mean? That's always going to be a puzzle as to why they choose, if they're allowed a choice, to yeah. come back at these various ages.
That's a possibility. And like I said, that would make sense, because as far as I know, that's the only death on that road that I could
yep.
find in talking to people
yep.
that had lived there even before the farm was there.
Yeah.
But that reminds me of another story, if I could put go
oh,
into
please.
This.
Yeah.
Somebody else told me that I thought was interesting. It's kind of along the same line.
Right.
Man went to visit his childhood home, the home that he grew up in,
yep.
and knocked on the door, introduced himself, and said, you know, I lived here when I was a child. And mm-hmm. The man said, yeah, come on in, look around, walk around the yard, do whatever you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But before he left, the man that was currently living there said, I want to ask you something. He said, when you lived here, did you ever get the feeling this place was haunted?
Mm.
And the guy was like, no, not really. And the man said, well, let me tell you what's happened to me. He said, I've seen a kid in the house and out in the yard. Like, he said, one time I saw him run down the hallway and into my bedroom.
Oh,
there's no other way out on that end of the house, but there was no child there.
Mm-hmm.
And the more he talked about this and described these encounters, and he talked about what the child was wearing and stuff, the man said, I've got something I want to show you. He went home. He just lived a few miles away, mm-hmm. came back, and he had some photos.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed the man the photos, and there was one of him standing on the front porch of that very house with an Easter basket. It was
mm-hmm.
Easter Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And the man says, that's him. He said, that's the little ghost boy that mm-hmm. I see running around in here. And the man says, you're not going to believe this, but that's me.
I knew you were going to say that.
And I lived here. So, you know, is that a possibility that you have like a doppelganger of yourself
mm-hmm.
that could be younger or older?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, that would make sense. He said, those were the happiest times of my life.
Right.
When I lived in that house.
Right.
We moved several miles away to another house. And he said, that was kind of when everything fell apart. My parents went bankrupt. This happened, that happened. And I was miserable. He said, from the time I was 15 on. But when I lived in that house as a small child, you know, everything was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like he was haunting the house and he was still alive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the most unusual stories I've ever heard. But I like the idea of that.
Let me add to that. I feel like I'm playing chess with you right now. I'm going to add something to your story and give you another story. How's that?
Okay.
So about a year or two ago, my husband and I went to a wedding, and then we stopped at a bed and breakfast on the way coming back to our home residence and stayed the night there. And of course, you always, when we stay at these bed and breakfasts, many of them are, they've got, you know, historical stories or hauntings and all that. So I told this to the woman. They always ask what you do. And I always feel like, do I dare say anything? Because the reaction sometimes is like they disregard you or they look away or they don't want you to say anything. They don't want to scare people. Some people don't mind. But anyway, we got into chatting, the owner and I, and next door to their house, that house had burned down. I don't know when it burned down, but it had burned down. But unfortunately, it took the lives of three of them in that house, a lady and a couple of the kids. Okay, so one of the younger children, of course, was haunting the house and putting handprints on the windows and all that stuff. But when her own child was getting to be about 4 or 5 years old, she always wanted to go play in the basement of that house. And so, yeah, sure, go ahead, whatever. You know, she didn't think anything was dangerous down there. And so, long story short, one day her child had said, I'd like to go play with my friend down in the basement, but she had no known playmates that were coming over or anything. And she would come up the stairs and go, I need to get something. I go back down to play with my friend. She goes, well, who's downstairs in the basement? And, my friend. And she gave her name. Well, we'll just call her Mary. Okay. And Mary, and of course, you know, now the mother's intrigued, right? And so this kid's young and all this, long story short, one day the little gal is walking through the living room and they have kept pictures of the former owners on the wall. And so the little girl stops. She goes, that kid, that's my friend. Oh my God, my friend's on the wall. Okay. She's all excited, right? Mm-hmm. That she says, that are you sure that's your friend? Because that friend doesn't live here anymore. That friend grew up as an old adult and moved away. And so longer story short, they actually tracked down this woman who was 95, 96 years old at the time, still alive, living in a kind of a hospice, you know, last moments care situation, coma, still alive though. The children of this woman said had helped assisted this, but what the long story of this is the woman was still alive but in a coma, and the children had said to the bed and breakfast owner, when she lived in this house, that was the happiest moment of her life, was when she was around about 5 years old, and then they moved to New York, and she was miserable, apparently, moving to New York, and all she could talk about was that house back in Minnesota, right? But mm-hmm. The woman was alive, 95 years old, but she was the image of the little girl who is the best friend of her daughter, who played together down in the basement.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. That reminds me of two separate stories.
Oh, bring it on.
The first one is kind of short, but I knew a woman that practiced a lot with a Ouija board. Yeah. And she contacted some entity on there one time that claimed he was in a coma, but he didn't know who he was or where he was in the hospital at. But he could hear doctors and nurses and people mm-hmm. talking about his condition. And I don't know if she ever followed up on that or not. So that one's pretty brief. But I think maybe it is possible. Maybe we don't know what the brain can do, especially in that type of situation, mm-hmm. because I've talked to people that have been in comas, yet knew or aware of what was going on. Maybe they couldn't see right. everything or only hear. But gives one pause for thought. Mm-hmm. And then the other story, in the area where I grew up, another child that I knew, her dad worked out at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory with my dad. Mm-hmm. And she and I used to play together when we were small. She was a year older than me, and I'd go over there when I was like 6 or 7. Mm-hmm. And our moms would have tea while we played, had our little play date. Mm-hmm. And we would sometimes go into the basement, and then all of a sudden she'd be like, we need to go outside. Let's go outside or something. Yeah, yeah. Now, I didn't think anything of it at the time. Then flash forward 40 years later, we reconnected on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And she was living in Arizona at the time, and had moved out there. They'd moved to Florida, and then she moved to Arizona as an adult. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't seen her since she was in high school. Mm-hmm. So she comes out to Portland to visit me. Mm-hmm. And we started talking about that house where she used to live. Mm-hmm. And I said, do you remember, like, we'd be downstairs playing a board game or something, and all of a sudden you'd say, we got to get out of here. Let's go outside. She had a tree house outside. And she said, yeah. She said, there was a kid from the neighborhood, I guess, that used to get in the basement somehow. Hmm. And she said, I would see him like behind some boxes or peeking out of the corner mm-hmm. and stuff. And she said, I only later in life came to realize that it was a spirit. There was a little boy in the basement, she said, because there was no way he could get in there without coming through the house. But she was afraid to tell her parents. Her dad was actually Peruvian, and her mom was from New York. But her dad was very, very strict and kind of rough on the whole family. And she said, if I went upstairs and told my dad there was a little boy in the basement, he would have accused me of letting him in there. And even if he couldn't find him, I would have got the belt.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, I know some things about that house that you probably don't know, because my family knew the original family that had lived there. They moved because their little boy, I think he was maybe 9 or 10 years old, drowned in a pond out behind that house in the edge of the woods.
There you go.
And I described what I've seen pictures of him and stuff. And she said, that sounds like the little boy that was in the basement. Mm-hmm. So it's the child ghost to me. I mean, they're the most tragic and yet some of the most fascinating ones. I had where I grew up there, we had 7 springs on that property there. 6 of them came out of the hillsides. 1 of them was artesian that came up out of the ground. They all fed into a bigger creek, which went down into the lake, which was, maybe 200 or 300 yards away. Well, there was occasionally these 2 little boys that would come down out of the woods. Now, we had 25 acres there. We kept about 5 of it cleared off. The rest of it was just old growth woods, and I played in the woods a lot.
Right.
But there were certain areas down there that didn't feel right. What we call the bottoms, which was on the other side of the creek, we had a big garden down there.
Yep.
And I don't know, I'd be down there, especially as it started getting dark. I'd hurry across the little bridge that my dad built and get back on the other side, and then I wouldn't feel that scary, oppressive feeling. And I didn't know it at the time, but a lot of people claim that ghosts can't cross running water.
Hmm.
So whatever was down there, it didn't follow me across the bridge. But there were times when these 2 little boys, I assume they were brothers, would come down out of the woods. They were dressed alike. One was probably 6 or 7, and the other maybe 8 or 10. Little flannel shirts, severely short haircuts. And this was in the early 70s, so I kind of had a Beatles thing going on. That was popular. These little kids had like buzz cuts,
yeah.
The flannel shirts, and new-looking blue jeans, like the ones that aren't faded at all,
right.
But that were cuffed way up like several inches. And
right.
That was what farm kids wore
right.
at one time, because you grew into your pants. Your mom would cuff them up, and then if you had a growth spurt over the summer, she'd let him out of your pants there.
Right.
Well, these 2 little kids would come out of the woods, and I would play with them down there, but they never talked. And I just thought, well, either they don't have anything to say or they can't talk. You know, maybe they were something like that.
Yeah.
But I would hear what sounded like a dinner bell would ring, and then they'd take off back up through the woods. And it was a really steep bank they had to go up.
Mm-hmm.
And years later, as an adult, I was in my 30s,
mm-hmm.
and I mentioned I was talking to my dad. We were talking about that place there where I grew up. And I said, well, who were those 2 little boys that I used to play with that came out of the woods? And he said, you mean your imaginary friends? And I'm like, no. I said, these were real little kids. And I described them. He's like, there was nobody around there like that. We would keep an eye on you when you were out down there. Mm-hmm. And there was never anybody around except for the neighbor boy. And they knew him. And again, I was in my probably late 30s, and I got a map and I showed him, and he said, well, see, this is where that bank you're talking about, where that bluff goes up.
Right.
He said, the only thing on the other side of that, it goes almost straight down to the lake.
Mm.
I'm like, well, did there used to be something over there? And he said, well, there used to be a church and a graveyard down there, but when they dammed up the Clinch River and made Melton Hill Lake, all that's underwater.
Oh.
And had been since like a year after I was born. So I think that was probably kids that had something to do that were maybe buried in that graveyard. And there were stories that circulated that in some of those places where they supposedly moved the graveyards and stuff,
right.
they only moved the stones and
right.
in the ground.
Of course.
So I'm thinking these 2 kids that I thought were real. I mean, they looked just as real as anybody else to me. But then it turns out I was the only one that saw him.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it odd at the time that they didn't talk, but you know, I was only 7 or 8 years old. Maybe they didn't have anything to say. It wasn't any of my business.
But did you play with them? I mean, did you actually play with them?
Well, I mean, I had a swing from a tree limb down
there.
They would swing on the swing.
They would swing with you on the swing.
Yeah. They would take turns. We would like play around the woods, like with sticks. So when I was a kid, you got a stick and it was a gun. Suddenly you were shooting at the bad guys. They would play games like that, but they wouldn't make the gun noises or anything.
Yeah.
And the more I thought about it, there was no real interaction other than, like swinging or doing something. I never had reason to touch them or shake hands or there was never any physical contact with them. But they seemed very corporeal, very real to me. I mean, they weren't invisible or anything. But I don't get the part about the bell. But when my dad said there used to be a church over the hill there where it was all underwater now, the church bell, they would ring that sometimes, not just to announce church, but to announce when there was an emergency or people needed to come to the church for whatever reason. And apparently they've also done that for funerals. In some places, they would ring that bell as a tribute to whoever had died.
Did you say you heard that bell?
I heard the bell.
Yeah, you heard the bell.
Because when they heard the bell, whatever they were doing, they would take off. I mean, gone.
Yeah, gone.
So,
wow. That's that.
Again, see, that was just my normal. It was kids that maybe, if I think real hard, I might have played with them 5 or 6 times.
Yeah,
the whole time that we lived there. And that house was built when I was 6 months old, and we moved away from there when I was in my mid-teens. So it was all when I was small. I never saw them after I, say, got up to middle school age or so. It's always when I was in elementary school.
Well, I think you know as well as I do, and you're as observant as most of us are. When little kids are around little kids, they don't care what you look like. They don't care how, if you're more around their age, oh my God, that just makes their day. You know, someone is around my age, we know what our language is. We can play or whatever. And so, of course, the language for you back then as a young tyke, of course, wow, I've got playmates now. Let's just go horse around, which is what kids do. They don't think about anything else. I mean, my God, but that is absolutely interesting. And so I'm going to go under the assumption, like you said, that what's under that lake or wherever that river or whatever is back there, that is like probably over a graveyard and there used to be a church there.
Yeah, that's 100% sure on that. It was I want to say 64, Tennessee Valley Authority dammed up the Clinch River and made Melton Hill Lake there in that part of East Tennessee.
And
my dad and mom both had lived in that area because that was near where my grandparents lived at the time when their dairy farm was in that area. And so they knew the history of the place. In fact, my brother went and stood at the edge of the river when the lake was being created, and he said he kept stepping backwards, as the water level would come up, because he was 17 years older than I am. I was late in life, unexpected baby. And he used to hunt down in there and stuff, so he knew the area well. And he remembers when the church was already disused then, and he was born in 46.
Wow.
So it had probably not been a church, an active church, since sometime in the 30s.
Yep.
But there was other stuff down there too. There's a drive-in theater that's underwater.
Oh, so, are you kidding me?
So who knows? Yeah, there it used to be the Riverview Drive-In was there, but the bridge that went over into Oak Ridge. Mm. And when they dammed the river up and made the lake, that all that's underwater.
Oh,
and that's why my grandparents moved their farm. When they backed the river up, they left their dairy barn sitting on a quarter of an acre. The rest of the dairy farm was underwater.
Yeah.
Now they paid them well for it, but just, the value of the land didn't take into account how much they made with the cows and the produce and things like that. So they moved about a half hour away to another part of East Tennessee and resumed operations there.
Fascinating. Correct me if I'm wrong on this, but let's see. How many kids grew up in your family, in yours?
Just my immediate family, just me and my older brother. He was my
just you two?
one sibling. And like I said, he was 17 when I was born. So by the time I was cognizant, he was already married, moved out,
yeah,
and had his own family. Mm-hmm. And my nephew, who's 4 years younger than me, mm-hmm, he was more like my little brother. Mm-hmm. And my brother was actually, he seemed like an uncle or something, you know, because he was so much older.
Yeah. When you're having these experiences, yeah, you just answered the question with the older brother. That one's probably, you know, golf gallivanting, doing something else. And here you are going through all these experiences as a younger type, but you do have, did you say cousin that was 4 years younger than you?
Nephew.
Got it.
My brother's child, first child.
There you go. Any experiences ever reported? Did you interact a lot? Were you together a lot, or once in a while kind of thing?
Nephew, they lived 2.5 miles away from where we were.
Yeah.
My nephew would come and visit occasionally, or I'd go over there, but it wasn't like an everyday thing, mm-hmm, stuff like that. And he's had a few strange experiences, but nothing like what I did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, though. So let's get into your, so you're writing still, right? You're taking notes down and writing things down. Let's talk a little bit about, because this is going to lead into a lot of what you're doing right now. So did anyone else ever, so you're writing things down. Did anyone else ever report to you along the way, so you at least had somebody to relate to what you were probably going through? You know, it's kind of tormenting to go through this by yourself. I mean, a little bit, yeah, because you're like, people, you don't dare tell anyone. They think you're crazy, you know? Oh, yeah, crazy.
Really, just my grandmother up until I was 13. Mm-hmm. She was the only one at that time that I shared stuff with. Mm-hmm. And she would tell me, because like I said, she had a lot of grandkids with, mm-hmm, nine boys, and some of them had been married 2 or 3 times. So to this day, I've got cousins I wouldn't recognize. But I was, like I said, I was her favorite because of the whole, veil over the face thing. Mm-hmm. And she would tell me, she's like, now don't tell there, because there are other cousins that lived there on the farm with her. There were 2 or 3 of the brothers had stayed on the farm and had their own houses. She'd be, now don't tell them, don't tell your cousin Jimmy or your cousin James about this. And she would bribe me. She would give me like a Hershey bar or sometimes, mm-hmm, a crisp $1 bill if, mm-hmm, I could repeat whatever superstition or, right, whatever it was she'd told me, if I could repeat it back to her. Hmm. And then she'd bribe me in the silence to not tell the other cousins, because they were normal and they wouldn't understand. Now that's her words.
Yeah, they wouldn't understand. And they were normal.
It didn't make me feel abnormal as much, yeah, as it made me feel special. But
yeah,
again, you know, normal is everybody's own thing as to what's normal. So no, I didn't really share that much with anybody else. Now I could talk to my mom some about it, yeah, and my dad, even though he was scientist, mm-hmm, he had a few things that he couldn't explain, but that's just what it was. I don't know what it was. I couldn't explain it.
Right.
There was no scientific explanation for it. So he wasn't a big believer in the paranormal like my mother was.
Right.
And then when I started writing these down, you know, a lot of, yeah, the people that I talked to and getting their experiences and stuff, that was, and again, this started when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
Talk to family members, you know, have you ever seen a ghost? Have you ever seen anything weird? Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen a light in the woods or anything you couldn't explain? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were just reticent to talk about stuff they had seen, mm-hmm, until they saw that I had a genuine interest and, right, was cataloging it. And,
right,
had a few people that really opened up once, mm-hmm, I listened to their story and didn't laugh and didn't call them crazy, mm-hmm, or,
right,
say that they were drinking or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the best part. That was sometimes the people that had the best stories was people that had never talked about it to anyone. I mean, I had one gentleman tell me just a plethora of stories. So he lived way back in the woods over there where my dad was from. He was a first generation American immigrant. His parents had come over from Ireland. Mm-hmm. And he had just a slew of stories. He wouldn't let me record him back in the day. I had a little reel-to-reel cassette recorder,
mm-hmm,
and he wouldn't let me. He said, you can take all the notes you want, but I don't want you recording my voice.
Oh, I know.
I don't know what that was all about, but I did my best to take notes.
Yeah.
But he told me stuff that he never told his wife or any of his kids or anything. Mm-hmm. And if they were there and heard some of this, they were like in shock, like, you never talked about that. And he's like, well, you know, why would I? Yeah. It's not something that you, for him anyway, it's not something you go around talking about. But mm-hmm. And just the more stories I found, the deeper I got into it and the more interesting I found it. And then, you know, as Nietzsche wrote, when you peer into the abyss peers into you. Mm-hmm. And I think that happens with the paranormal. I think once you start poking around mm-hmm. and looking at stuff, you can draw attention to yourself. Mm-hmm. And I thought for years that every place I've ever lived was haunted to some degree or another. Mm-hmm. And then just a few years ago, I came to the conclusion that it wasn't so much the places, it's me that's haunted, that mm-hmm. I draw this stuff. And I've had other people like me tell me that it's like a moth to a flame or whatever, that mm-hmm. if there's stuff out there in the dark, you're like a candle, they're going to come to you because of your energy and mm-hmm. your spirit and this vibration that you give off. And you're talking about the bed and breakfast stories. I like to call them the dead and breakfast.
Yeah.
The ones that are haunted.
The dead breakfast.
I've had some interesting accounts in those places too. And one place I was talking to the owners, and they admitted it, but they're like, whatever you do, don't cross our ghost over. They'd had some sort of medium come in, and she was going to cross this person over, you know, have them go into the light or whatever. Yeah. And they're like, get out of here. This is our bread and butter. Mm-hmm. Like, the ghost is happy here. Leave him alone. Yeah. He's their attraction. We wouldn't be able to rent rooms if mm-hmm. we didn't have a resident ghost. And they physically told her to get out.
Oh, so, yeah. Well, you know, that's the whole thing. Some of them will love to be advertised as a haunted bed and breakfast or place, you know, location in general. And others are like, you're going to ruin our business if you even mention the fact that you had an experience. I'll give you one here. So, Yosemite National Park, just outside of it, Groveland Hotel, X number of years ago. Can't remember how long ago. Known haunted. I wouldn't call it a bed and breakfast. I'd call it a haunted hotel in the just outside of the Yosemite gates. Okay. And went there, couldn't get in the Lyle room. Lyle was known to do all kinds of things in his room. Was down the hallway, can't remember the name of it anymore, but was down the hallway from that one and told my husband, yeah, kind of bummed here. Wanted to have a haunted experience. And well, if the place is haunted, they can go through a wall if they really want to. But apparently that night, clear sky, you know, way up high, kind of in the mountainy area, whatever. Can't remember what it was, silver or something in that they were mining back, you know, whatever. And about 2 o'clock a.m., I am kicked up with a foot underneath my back, and I am thrusted literally what felt like more, but it was probably about a good foot to a foot and a half in the air, flying up in the air. I was sleeping, bouncing, waking up, bouncing on the bed and going, what the was that? And I will never forget. I thought to myself, cool, I just had a haunted experience in here. All right, amen. I can write about it in my book, which I did. But next morning, checkout time, couple comes in laughing and giggling. Yeah, we'd like to stay in your haunted room. Hee, hee, hee. And I looked like I just went through a train wreck, right? And I said, would you like to stay in our room? Because last night I was kicked up in the air and I was bouncing on the bed. But if you do decide to do that, be really nice in there because they don't like snore. The ghost in there doesn't like a person that snores. So have a good day. And I left with, you know, out the door with my husband and stuff. I've written about it. But yeah, it's interesting because you'll get the people that want the experience. And then you get the people that are like, they think this is all a bunch of hokey. And mm-hmm. then you get people like me that go into the most haunted, terrifying situation ever and swear off ghosts for 3 years. That's the question I want to ask you now. Mm-hmm. What is your most, in your view, because you've been through this since you were a young tyke. I mean, this has been with you for many, many years. Was there ever a situation where it was like something so terrifying that you, like in my case, I swore them off for 3 years. I wouldn't even think about it. I just didn't want anything to do with ghosts anymore. But have you ever been through a real terrifying experience? And if so, What was that?
Oh gosh, so there's been two or three, I think, but it didn't make me want to swear it off. I mean, I was genuinely scared, but still even that much more fascinated. I'll tell this one because I've already talked about there where I grew up, talked about the property and how it had Seven Springs on it. So, well, up the border of that one side of that property, there was an old ditch line there. Found out much later that that had been the old wagon and stagecoach road through the area before paved roads. Right. Well, I was had walked up there. I was 8 years old at the time, and I had walked up and was just kind of looking down in the edge of the ditch. It was probably 10 or 12 feet down there. Mm-hmm. And I'd played in other parts of it on the other end where you could actually walk into it and didn't have to climb down. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't really anything to see. I just turned around and started to walk away, and I heard something in the leaves. Mm-hmm. And I turned around, and whatever this was, came up over the lip of the ditch. Mm-hmm. It was headed straight for me. The leaves were flying up in its wake. Tree limbs a lot higher than my head were being brushed out of the way. Mm-hmm. But there was nothing that I could see. I could see the effect it was having on everything. Right. And I stood there frozen for just a moment. I can see it's coming right at me. I could feel the footfalls, Doctor, when it was stomping or whatever it was doing when it was running toward me. It was reverberating on the ground. Mm-hmm. So the paralysis broke. I tore back down the hill. I was about a quarter mile away from the house. And I was screaming and making such a racket that my mom came out on the back porch to see what all the fuss was. Mm-hmm. She thought I'd seen a snake or something.
Yeah.
I continued past her and went in the house. I think I hid under the mm-hmm. bed or behind the couch or something. I was absolutely terrified out of my mind. Mm-hmm. And she finally got me calmed down. About that time, my dad got home from work, and my brother, who lived 2.5 miles away with his family, he had just happened to stop by. And she was telling him, you know, well, something scared Steve to death in the woods. Mm-hmm. And I was telling him this, and they were going, was it a bear? Was it a deer? Mm-hmm. No. I grew up in East Tennessee. I've seen bear in the Smokies. Mm-hmm. I've seen deer. I know what all those look like. You can see those things. This was big, and it was coming after me, and I couldn't see anything. That's what was so scary about it. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, we don't know. Don't just stay away from up there. Don't go up there anymore. And I didn't. I stayed away for a long time. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, when the little kid that lived a mile or so away, when he would come over to play, I would actually send him up there. I'm like, go up there and look down in the ditch and see what you see. I'm going to stay down here behind this tree. You know, I didn't tell him the whole story. And he went up there. You know, he was my bait. And he's like, look around. Mm-hmm. He's like, I don't see anything. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, come on back. Mm-hmm. And said my dad and my brother went up there and looked around. I wouldn't go near it. They didn't see anything. They could see where something had disturbed the ground. It's just a bed of leaves up there because of those many trees. Didn't bother the neighbor kid. Well, flash forward 7 years later, I'm 15 at this time. We're getting ready to move from there. Mm-hmm. With sold the farm and bought a house in a subdivision farther up the road near where I went, was going to go to high school. Mm-hmm. And I was just kind of walking the property and looking at some of my old haunts and places that I'd played in the woods, because I had forts and tree houses and mm-hmm. This, that, and the other. And I walked back up there. It's the first time I'd been there since I was 8 years old. Mm-hmm. And I'm just kind of wondering what scared me that day. You know, and I look down in the ditch. I don't see anything. Mm-hmm. Well, Kelly, I turned to walk away, mm-hmm. and I hear something in the leaves. Mm-hmm. And just immediately, I'm like, and I turned around. Mm-hmm. Same thing again. Mm-hmm. Comes up over the edge of the ditch. Mm-hmm. I can hear feel the footfalls. It's mm-hmm. coming toward me. The leaves are kicking up. The trees are being pushed out of the way, little saplings and stuff. Mm-hmm. There's nothing there. Now, I didn't run screaming and crying that time, but I didn't waste any time getting out of there. Mm-hmm. And went back to the house, and that time I said, I'll never go back. And I haven't to this day, although I've considered going back just to see if whatever it is still there. Well, there's another part to this story. Yeah. That was when I was 15. We'll mm-hmm. flash forward 6 more years. Mm-hmm. I'm 21 at this point. I'm working in West Knoxville. Mm-hmm. And a guy that I just knew from work, and I didn't really know him at all, said, hey, after work, there's a party at these apartments over here. Won't you come? Mm-hmm. So I went along with him to this party, and there was maybe 20 or 30 people crammed into the basement of this. It was like apartments, but they had a rec room or whatever, and there was a basement downstairs that the residents could use. Mm-hmm. And there's all these people crammed down there. And some of the girls found a Ouija board under the couch. So like, oh, do this. Let's, you know, we'll turn the lights down and this will be some spooky fun. So these, I think there was three, maybe four of them working the board, and they were going around the room asking people stuff. And when they got to me, I thought, I've got one for your Ouija board here. I said, and this is all I said, what scared me when I was a child?
Right.
Nothing else. No, but I didn't know anybody there other than the guy that I came with. He didn't, he'd never heard that story because that's not one I shared very often then. And the Ouija board, it, it's doing like a figure eight or an infinity symbol. And it spells out W-A-T-E-R-S-P-R-I-T-E, water sprite. And, They looked at me and I just shrugged my shoulders and they started laughing. Oh, well, maybe the board's thirsty. It wants a drink. It wants some water or it wants a Sprite.
Like,
okay, whatever. They went on to somebody else. And but the next day, now this was before the internet. This was in the early 80s. I went to the big library downtown and went up to the reference desk and I said, what can you tell me about a water Sprite or a water spirit? Sure enough, she comes back with several books later and, there were two in particular that were very interesting to me. There was a naiad, which was like a wood nymph or a water nymph that guarded the waters. And then there was a dryad, which was the spirit of the trees that guarded the trees. So according to the Ouija board, it was a naiad, which, you know, if you look at pictures of fairies and the fae folk and stuff, they're these little gossamer things. They've all been Disney-fied. And you think Tinkerbell.
Right.
Whatever this was, it was like an elemental or something. It was huge.
Right.
But according to the Ouija board, what I encountered was a dryad. And that makes sense. Like I said, that place, it had an aura to it. It felt magical when I was a kid. And then you think about seven natural springs in a place. Seven is a good number. And all those woods. And then the fact that that had been a road through there at one time, back to the Revolutionary War era. We found a lot of artifacts down there by the creek from the Civil War. And I think a lot of people probably stopped there to get a drink out of that creek because years later in the 20s and 30s, people got their water out of there. But I think during the Civil War, there were probably people that camped there or stopped to drink and got ambushed and killed. We found broken bayonets. We found the mini balls. One guy found a belt buckle with a metal detector, a CSA buckle. So it was a weird place just in general. And again, I don't know why the thing would only chase me away other than if I believe, like my grandma told me, that I saw things and felt things and knew things that most people wouldn't. And it knew that if I spent too much time there, I'd find something I wasn't supposed to find or it didn't want me to find. So that was the other story. There was a rumor there from the time my mom was a little girl that there was buried treasure on that property.
Right.
So there you go. And I always thought, you know, like the pirate thing, when they hid their treasure, a lot of times they would kill a crew member so that their spirit would protect the treasure. And I thought maybe that's what I encountered. But again, according to the Ouija board, it was an element or a spirit, a water sprite or a water spirit.
We need to stop here. Let's now head over to part two of the Steve Stockton interview.